Some of you may know me as an historian of science. I've been looking at the history of holography for about the past 4 or 5 years. So that's why my face is here now. I initially planned to give one talk, which I will give a bit later on, but Hans asked me to give a couple of brief overviews of the two careers of Emmett Leith and Yuri Deniziuk. First, Emmett Leith. Emmett Leith's early career began over half a century ago. Most of his contemporaries stopped long ago with their careers, and much of Emmett's early career was classified. So most of his early career isn't very well known about by most holographers. So it's appropriate for me as a historian to treat Emmett as a historical figure. Nevertheless, much of what I know about him came from his own mouth. I spent a couple of weeks with him in Ann Arbor a few years ago, and much of it came from his file cabinet and his boxes of files at home and at work and at the university records. So I know of him as a human being, but also as a historical figure. Why remember Emmett Leith? Well, during the 1950s, he played a crucial role in synthesizing a new subject from previously quite separate ones. During the early 1960s, he dramatically extended the possibilities of wavefront reconstruction, and with equal modesty, publicized them. His ideas and competence inspired a generation of colleagues, many of whom went on to contribute to the modern subject, art, and science of holography. And he displayed an uncommon coherence in his own career and his own intellectual interests, although his own career mutated from classified work to popularization to academic thinking. Now, this account is a partial one. It focuses on the first 2 decades of his life, and it's not meant to indicate that he peaked early. Quite the opposite. Emmett Leith had a viable, fruitful career from beginning to end, and he worked unusually long, for about 50 years, as an academic and a scientist. Emmett was born in Detroit, Michigan in 1927, and he grew up there. And at the age of 18, just as the Second World War was ending, he enlisted in the Navy. He didn't see active service. He obtained a Bachelor of Science degree and then a Master of Science degree at nearby Wayne State University. And as soon as he had his second degree, he began work at Willow Run Labs in Michigan. This is Willow Run Labs today. Emmett spent 13 years of his life at this place, near the Willow Run Airport, and it was a branch of the University of Michigan dedicated to classified research. It had been set up in 1946 to do classified research and only classified research, and his first 13 years were spent there doing just that. It had large budgets to develop infrared, radar, computing, and other technologies for the battlefield. For example, the building in the foreground, that building there, the first Ruby Maser was developed, not by Emmett Leith's group, but by another group. In the building circled, the very first synthetic aperture radar research was done, and he spent about a decade in that building. And he then moved further west to a separate building where he did holography a bit later on. One of the areas under investigation at Willow Run was the development of a variant of radar called synthetic aperture radar, or SAR. Now, in a SAR system, the radar waves would be pulsed, as in conventional radar, but both the time of arrival and the frequency of the return echoes would be measured. And from this data, a radar image could be reconstructed. Now, the earliest schemes relied on electronic processing, quite crude electronic processing, but Leith and a handful of colleagues conceived an optical method of treating the data. The bright area at the bottom of this image is the Willow Run Labs themselves, where the system was developed. Now, Leith volunteered for this optical processing project because he had taken more optics courses than any of his electrical engineering colleagues. He had taken 4 courses as an undergraduate. And very gradually, from 1954 to 1958, he began to conceive generalizations of what optical processing could do. Communication theory was familiar to all the electrical engineers at Willow Run, and it could be combined with modern optics. and he came to realize that sophisticated mathematical transformations and correlations and spatial filtering could be done using optical systems. Now, that was a new idea in the 1950s. No one had done it to any degree. And Leith's group took this idea and ran with it from the 1950s right up to the 1980s. By the late 1950s, the group had developed this optical processing system. Now, to give you an idea, the lenses are about this diameter, and the system is about this high. It was set up on steel rails, on steel optical mounts, holding large format, defect-free, very expensive lenses on top. This was a coherent optical system. It used monochromatic mercury light, and it converted synthetic aperture radar film images into an optical image. Now, by 1958, Leith had conceived generalizations of this idea to make it more powerful and more compact. He tried using chirped radar pulses, and suddenly the work began to look familiar to us, because the images produced on film began to look like distorted, elongated holograms. And around this time, he realized that what he was producing was rather like what Dennis Gabor had produced a decade earlier. So he began to see a similarity with earlier work. Leith worked quietly away on variants of the optical processor right through the 1950s, and he began to work out deeper principles. By 1958, he knew about Dennis Gabor's work, he had ideas about where he could go with it, and hoped that he might be able to take these ideas a step further. In 1960, Leith had risen to research engineer, and at that point, Juris Upatniks joined as a research assistant. And the two of them together as a side project, with the ample military funding, decided to try out these ideas and see whether they could use their synthetic aperture radar experience for wavefront reconstruction. So they began to reproduce what Dennis Gabor had done, and this is their very first reconstruction with a near copy of what Gabor had done. By 1961, they had produced a couple of papers, quite important papers. In the first, they described the off-axis geometry for wavefront reconstruction. This was produced by diffraction gratings or prisms or mirrors to divide and deviate separate sample and reference beams for the first time. The scheme solved the conjugate image problem that had baffled Gabor and workers of the 1950s. And they solved them. They solved them very elegantly and very perfectly. Very high quality images resulted. In the second paper they wrote, they formalized the connection between wavefront reconstruction and communication theory, something that hadn't been explored by any other worker. Leith and Upatniks combined theoretical elegance with meticulous experimental techniques. This was not a breakthrough discovery. This was long, hard, slogging work for several years. None of this was an accidental discovery. The project reports indicate just how carefully they extended the work with their expertise in synthetic aperture radar into wavefront reconstruction. And none of this had anything to do with lasers. They weren't using lasers at this time. But there the project stopped. Mid-1961, Juris Upatniks decided to take military leave, and he worked in the military for 18 months, and the project simply stopped. Around this time, the optics group moved to a new, more secure building that they called the Blockhouse. Now, the Blockhouse, as you can tell from this image, is a radiation-hardened, windowless, very secure building in the middle of the Willow Run site that was ideal for holography. Strong foundations, no light, perfect conditions. The Blockhouse had been the nerve center for the Bomark anti-ballistic missile project a few years earlier. When Upatniks returned in late 1962, they resumed the project by attempting something new. They thought of trying to record holograms of grayscale transparencies. Now, Gabor and they up to that point had only looked at binary images, black and white images. This was a step forward. They struggled with the dim light from their mercury arc lamps, and they obtained their first really good result at Christmas using a helium neon laser. Their paper on the work showed the first high-quality reconstructed images of two-dimensional objects, and these are the very first examples they produced. The top picture is of Emmett Leith's daughter, Kim. The bottom image is of Yuris Upatnik's brother, Ujars. This is how the work was first reported in public. At Christmas time 1963, the American Institute of Physics thought this will make a great story for our forthcoming conference. And they publicized it under the key word lensless photography. So the American Institute of Physics thought of this term lensless photography. And it took off like wildfire. Suddenly, newspapers around the world reported that these grayscale, two-dimensional images could be produced by a laser beam and by a very arcane process that seemed magical. And it made headlines around the world. This is an image of the hologram on the left and Kim Leith on the right. And here's the very first publicity photograph, taken in early 1964. The apparatus, it turns out, was never used, and it was a kind of hologram copier, so it was a kind of dud. But it sold newspapers. Lensless photography seemed amazing. Newspapers were full of it because it sounded like the next generation of holography itself. It created an image from a seemingly meaningless negative and without any lenses at all. It could recreate the image from any part of this hologram, but it was publicized mainly in photographic pages. So this is in a Michigan newspaper in the photographic section on a Sunday afternoon. But at the same time that lensless photography was being touted, Leith and Upatniks were extending it dramatically. During 1963, they tried diffuse illumination of transparencies. Now, that may not sound very dramatic, but it's fundamentally extremely similar to three-dimensional images. By Christmas 1963, they had managed to record three-dimensional holograms for the first time. And little by little, first to colleagues at Willow Run, and then around Michigan, and then around America, and eventually further afield, the word leaked out. And by April of the next year, at the OSA meeting that was held, they suddenly found themselves catapulted into fame. This was the object of the acclaim. This is the first widely seen 3D hologram reconstruction of a toy train. Each new body of spectators had the same startled response. At a National Electronics Conference in 1965, 18 months after their discovery, one magazine reported reactions of the spectators. One said, "It's the most startling thing I've ever seen," said one nuclear physicist from Argonne National Labs. A Navy captain said, "It's fantastic. I don't see how it can be done." Many of those who viewed and touched the picture wanted to assure themselves that it was indeed flat, and the Michigan exhibitors were not trying to pull a fast one. Publicity by companies took it up as well. This is one of the first adverts to use a hologram by Spectrophysics, the company that had allowed them to use their lasers to make them. And they got more and more publicity. They began wearing ties. They began going to conferences, selling the ideas to engineers around America. It wasn't until late 1964, though, that the American Institute of Physics began to talk about 3D holography. So word really did take time to seep out. So after 4 years of very quiet, very methodical research, Leith and Upatniks were suddenly catapulted into the public world. Now, at this time, Leith had a master's degree in physics. He had never published openly. He had published in military conferences about military issues, and he was quite unknown. And in fact, he wasn't allowed to publish in combination with SAR research because no one wanted the secret to leak out that SAR research depended on optical processing. So Leith's research was very much cubbyholed into an arcane area that could not be publicized. So this was something new. From May 1964, he was in the headlines. And for the next 2 years, he gave papers at engineering conferences around America, telling every variety of engineer about what this new subject was and what it promised. I won't run through all of the kinds of things he came up with, but his group proved to be very fertile. This was a group of about two dozen optical engineers and scientists who had spent about a decade working on optical processing ideas. And very rapidly indeed, they came up with many new ideas of how to use holography. So, for example, holographic contouring, holographic interferometry, complex filtering, color reconstruction ideas, angle multiplexing, things that we don't give much thought to today, were brand new ideas in 1964 and 1965. Leith found himself in a curious position. He was balanced between ongoing SAR research and optical processing that was classified and the public world of what was now being called holography. Given this new public emphasis, the optics group was moved to the University of Michigan campus, where grad students could now show holograms to visitors off the street. So the aim was to publicize this research openly, to use it for teaching postgraduate students, and for making publicity as well. This gave the group a much wider remit, but it also aggravated some existing problems. This building, the Institute of Science and Technology, was known as Fort Apache to some of its residents, partly because of the neo-Aztec exterior, but also because of some endemic problems. It was a battlefield. The first problem was that it brought Willow Run, and especially the optics group, face-to-face with student protests during the Vietnam War. Now, it has to be said that what the optics lab was doing was certainly classified research, but just as much research was being done across the road in the electrical engineering building. Nevertheless, the university decided that the solution was to dissociate from Willow Run Labs, and they were moved to just off campus in 1972 to what was euphemistically called the Environmental Research Institute of Michigan. Emmett Leith, as chief scientist at ERIM, faced occasional protests as late as the 1980s. So this was a man who faced pretty perennial student protest. There were also problems because of run-ins with a rival at the University of Michigan, Professor George Stroke. Now, here's a rare photo of Leith and George Stroke at the same table at a spy meeting. Stroke, who had joined the university as professor in late 1963, just when lensless photography was leaking out, eclipsed Leith during the mid-1960s. When Leith went to engineering conferences around America, Stroke went to scientific conferences around the world. Stroke claimed that the advice and research that he had given had founded modern holography. Now, having spent a lot of time talking about these issues with Emmett and a lot of his former colleagues, I'm quite convinced that he was quietly dismayed by this for the rest of his life, for the rest of his career. He kept a meticulously organized box of documents relating to these run-ins, episode by episode, and he could recall quite accurately what the documents said. And I'm talking about documents he hadn't seen for 40 years. So given his account, given the account of his colleagues and the documents of the University of Michigan, I'm convinced that the Stroke affair was entirely one-sided and that Emmett was essentially blameless in the affair. Nevertheless, Stroke's account carried great weight. It had a great deal to do with how the history of holography was presented, and it almost certainly cost Leith and Denisyuk the Nobel Prize. Stroke left the university in 1967, and at subsequent conferences, Leith's status steadily grew. Here he is at the first Gordon Conference in 1972, proposed by John Caulfield. And here he is a decade later, now front row center. Now, Leith clearly won many awards, most of them from his native country, from America, but he became a very award-heavy individual indeed, highly respected later in his career. He didn't win the Nobel Prize, but he certainly won just about every award going for optical physics. Now, Leith was first and foremost a scientist. He told me one afternoon, "I'm a paper writer. I have no interest in reducing ideas to practice." But he did have interest in popularizing the medium and some interest in art as well. This is a hologram created by Fritz Goro of Life magazine with Leith and Upatniks in 1966. And it's the earliest attempt to make an aesthetically pleasing hologram. Now, no one called it art, but it was meant to be aesthetically pleasing at least. Until that point, the standard hologram had been chess pieces, knickknacks, laboratory objects, micrometers, and so on. So this was a step forward. This is the same model 40 years later. And this is Emmett looking at it for the first time 40 years later. until a few months ago it was buried in a, as you can see, in the back of an unused lab at the University of Michigan. I hope today it's been collected by Eurysiu Patniks or others at the university. Emmett kept a chaotic assortment of holograms and documents in his office and labs, and still more at home. When he died last December, they remained disorganized, but fortunately not lost. As far as I know, his colleagues at Michigan have been pretty scrupulous about collecting up all these objects, all these archives, and putting them in the proper place. And I hope that's a general feature of all scientists' careers. It's not just famous scientists like Leith, but every scientist who should think about archiving work in this way. Let me conclude with just a personal note. I first heard of Emmett Leith when I was a boy in the late 60s reading an article in Science Digest magazine. I never imagined that one day I'd actually meet the man, and the man I met eventually at the age of 76 was very unlike the scientist in the magazine. The mysterious young scientist in the magazine was something rather different from the very affable, friendly, energetic scientist I met in his late 70s. Most scientists are productive for a few decades. Leith remained vigorous for over 50 years. I watched him swim at a local lake, interact enthusiastically with his grad students over coffee and seminars, repair a heater in his old car, and shuffle papers ineffectually. Even then, Emmett was too busy working to think of himself as finished.